inclusion of Jewish life in the United States. And so I have funded, my wife and I have funded, and some other members of my family have made contributions, but the fund is entitled Alec and Anna F. Lowenthal Foundation at Harvard, Yale, and Stanford. The history and the study of Jewish women. We have done that. There are all kinds of funds set up for various Jewish studies in various places. The reason I did this was for Jewish women was, the first place Jewish women, my wife and I are very strong advocates of women's movements. And so my daughter is a very, very important feminist, see. And my daughter was particularly interested, and particularly most people don't know very much. They all believe because Jewish women in Orthodox synagogue had to sit behind screens up in the balcony, but they were nobodies. Well, they were somebodies. And they raised the Jewish people. All Jews were raised by Jewish mothers, you know, and so on. And so we have funded these three things, and that's my big thing. But since I was interested in that, I am one of the, shall I say, a rather sizable contributor to the thinking. But I never had the kind of money. I was a big contributor financially, but I am a big contributor financially also to the Model Judaic Studies program at Yale University. Yale University has decided that because most universities now are setting up Judaic Studies program, and up until now, up until a couple of years ago, if a student at Yale wanted to study Hebrew, he studied at the Yale Divinity School. Or if he wanted to study Jewish history, he studied at the Divinity School. Now, we have set up a program, we divided it into four parts, we set up a model for all universities who want to set up Judaic programs to follow, see. And we divided them into four parts, and we funded the whole thing. And in the process, that took $7.5 million to fund it. Oh yeah, because all the four professors, the four were funded $1 million each, the associate professors $500,000 each, the assistant professors $250,000 each, and the clerks and the librarians $250,000. In the process, we had not established the Holocaust Center. We established.
Where did the $7.5 million come from?
From Yale alumni. Foundations of Yale alumni.
Okay.
Well, not necessarily Yale alumni. Jewish foundation, like the Revson Foundation, they're not Jews, so on. But anyway, from foundations, predominantly, I'm from very rich Jews. But anyway, we finally found out that, you know, the Holocaust is involved in this whole thing. So we finally decided to set up the greatest Holocaust center in the United States, at Yale. And all the material that every city has, a copy of it, a picture of it, or something, is at Yale. And we needed $7.5 million more for that. And we raised that. And so Yale is the great center for all Holocaust studies in the United States. Now, I am next week, on the 15th of September, I am meeting with the new president of Yale.
Oh. How about that? Isn't that exciting?
Isn't that wonderful?
There we are. No, that's American Jewish Archives.
Giacometti?
Mr. Rose gave us $1 million for the old Judaic program.
Who was Mr. Rose? He's Billy Rose.
No. I knew Billy Rose. Okay. I should have told you about Ann and I worked with Billy Rose to set up the Rose Garden at the Israel Museum.
Oh, yes.
We spent 2 weeks with Billy Rose.
That was beautiful.
And I told you, I'm a founder of the Israel Museum. Mm-hmm. My name's carved in the Israel Museum and so on. But anyway, we set up this thing at Yale. Mm-hmm. This is crazy. Our success, our success overwhelmed us. We endowed four full professors with $1 million each. You know what? That's not enough. The income's about $100,000 a year, see? And for the professor and a couple of secretaries, that's not enough anymore. So when we set it up, the example at Stanford, they had to endow the full professors with $1.5 million. because there's the income of $1 million isn't enough. So we're holding a new meeting right now. Our success is so great that in the first week we don't have enough professors. 1/3 of the student body at Yale is Jewish. 1/3. 1/3 of the student body. 1/3 of the faculty is Jewish. And everybody wants to take a Jewish subject now. And we are so underfinanced, underorganized, that this is the purpose of the meeting where you see the president of Yale has called us together. The president of Yale. And we're meeting at a club in New York to see how we can further the program.
Would you be there?
So you were really instrumental in the very beginning studies at Yale.
I can show you all the literature. Oh, I'm on the very beginning of it, see? And this is my baby. I'm more interested in that. I'll give him some more money. I don't have any money. Uh-huh. I retired 50 years ago. What I thought was enough then, nothing. But it's enough. I'm not complaining.
Did you help to raise the money now, did you say?
Certainly I'm going to. Yes. No, Yale has a machinery for that. They have a whole big machinery for it. But we lay the plans, and you got to be behind it. You know how it is, and so on and so forth. But these men here, if you read in last Sunday's New York Times, Yale President Benno Schmidt will be there. He'd never been to the meeting. He's a new president. I haven't met him yet. But anyway, Jeffrey Hartman. If you read last Sunday's New York Times, did you realize that?
Mm-hmm.
There is a famous case that developed at Yale called the Daltman case.
Daltman, did you say?
Yeah. No, not Daltman. A name like that. Daltman was not a Jew, a Christian from Belgium. And when Hitler came up, he became an accessory to Hitler. And he wrote the most anti-Semitic articles for Le Soir, the French magazine, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
After Hitler was out and so on and so forth, this smart guy, he is smart, believe me, came to America. Apparently he had married, by the way, a woman, had 3 children, he sent them down to the Argentine. And he came to America, and he got a job. He was plenty smart, and he's one of the greatest, there's no question about the ability of the comparative literature men in the world. I don't care what you say. He's the best. He got this job first at this woman's school, and he fell in love with a gal, was a student of his, but he became a professor there, then he became a professor at Harvard, and then Yale took him away from Harvard to join Jeffrey Hartman. Jeffrey Hartman is a survivor. And Jeffrey Hartman is a head of comparative literature at Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And to be associated with Jeffrey Hartman, they brought this man on, and he fooled Jeffrey Hartman, he fooled everybody. And he died just about a little over a year ago. And Jeffrey Hartman has now found out that that name he used, and he was the guy wrote the most anti-Semitic articles against Jews under Hitler, and so on. But Jeffrey Hartman is my good friend. Now, Jeffrey Hartman is a real man behind the actual creation of the Jewish study. But then my children, my daughter, and my son-in-law at Sanford are so intense. They've given up everything else now, and they're devoted to my son-in-law gives a course in creative Jewish writing. As a matter of fact, in the mail today, he sent me a new book on a German survivor who was the greatest Holocaust poet, with Nellie Sachs. But Nellie Sachs got the Nobel Prize, but he committed suicide. His name is Paul. I don't think of them as that.
Mm-hmm.
I got a new article on it today from my son-in-law, from the magazine. But my son-in-law is the greatest translator of this man here, see. But my son-in-law teaches Hebrew creative writing, and he's translating Abba Kovner from the Hebrew. His big field was translating from the French and from the German and so on, and from the Spanish. I mean, he won the gold prize for the best American nonfiction book in 1980 on the translation of Neruda from the Spanish. He won that. But now
is
it's all.
At Stanford, did you say?
Yes, he's a professor of English.
What's his first name?
John Felser.
Yes.
My daughter's name is Mary Lowenthal Felser.
And they teach at Stanford?
Both of them. Well, you know, Mary is no longer at Stanford. Stanford wouldn't give her tenure, because they won't give husband and wife tenure. Uh-huh. So she's now a full professor. Well, she's scholar in residence at Stanford, but she teaches at the San Francisco State University, one of the California state universities. But my daughter and son-in-law, I just mentioned, were just at the great conference at Oxford University. My daughter and my son both read papers at the great conference on the Holocaust at Oxford.
Well, we can see that everything you believed in is carrying on.
It all had a piece. It all belongs together. See? Now, I wanted to mention some things here. So what did I do here in Pittsburgh? I can only remember, now what did I do on a national scale? I was the national chairman of sales, I said. I want to tell you the names of the various organizations.
We did get that. We were very
No, you didn't get this, though. I was for actually doing the work of creating the economy. I was the president of the American Financial and Development Corporation for Israel. I was the president. I was the national chairman for cash sales for Israel bonds. I was, well, I said the national chairman of Israel Appeal, Palestine Appeal.
President of American Financial Corporation for Israel.
Okay. Oh, I'll tell you what. I also served with the chairman of the board of General Motors and the chairman of the board of RCA and the chairman of the board of Chase Manhattan Bank in 1932 in a group that put itself entitled Peace by Investment. I was a member of the board with all these people in Peace by Investment. And this was put together by Leon Keisling, who picked me to be one of the main Jewish representatives on this board. But anyway, I've served in all these capacities.
Do you think we're doing enough with the development of Israel economically and privately?
It's gotten so tremendous that it now, if you're asking my opinion, it has nothing to do with my life right now, but I've been working at it. Well, I can tell you this. In 1953 or 54, after a couple of years after the state was created, and we floated the first Israel bond issue, see? Mm-hmm. Oh, I wanted to say this about Israel bond issue. Before we decided to go ahead that we needed the $500 million for a three-year period, this is after we knew what the contributions would be from all sources, Zionist sources, Hadassah sources, UJA sources, all that kind of stuff, and things like that. We held a meeting at Plum Point, New York, and Ben Gurion came over, Esther Kaplan came over, Esther Kaplan was the first Minister of Finance of them, and so on and so forth, and came over. We had a meeting at Plum Point, and the question is, we knew we had to go through the SEC, we worked that out, see. The question was, since Israel had no history of credit, because the state was just founded, see, and the economy was a little organized by this, but they had kibbutzim. See, they weren't organized by one man, see. And then they had the Hisadrut. The labor organization had started certain companies, as it were, to build roads and harbors and electrical work and big things like that, see. And the colonies, too. And kibbutzim, by the way, too. Mm-hmm. And so on. But anyway, the question came, what interest rate should they pay? Leon Keisling, I'll never forget the speech as long as he was then the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers for President Truman, that's what he was then, see, made a speech and he said, we have to start off that this is going to be the finest credit in the world, and we have to make it the finest credit in the world. And we will pay 1/4% less than the United States government pays on its bond, and the United States government was paying 3.75%, and the first Israel bond issue is 3.5%. And it has since been that way. And we have since sold $9 billion worth of Israel bonds. And it's considered the finest credit in the world. And the Israel bonds now are owned by pension funds and by insurance companies and by banks and by all kinds of money funds of every kind. Israel bonds are. And they are considered the finest credit there is in the whole world.
Has recent events had any effect on the credit?
Now, mm-hmm. What I want to tell you was, after we sold, after we had the first issue, which was a 3-year issue, the Histadrut, that was the savers created, right? The Histadrut, which was the labor union, see? Socialist labor union. They had started these various enterprises. Chemical fertilizer, because they found in the Dead Sea, for example, there were chemicals, you know. And they found there were, in the Negev, there was borax and things like that. And they found there were other kind of rare metals. And Israel had to do something very special. Because they couldn't compete in the world unless they had something special in the world. These bromides were specials. The fertilizer was special. And they started called Fertilizer and Chemical Company, and they started core industries. That's to build roads, harbors, and so on and so forth. And they started all this kind of, and today, he started with the labor union, is the largest employer in Israel. It still is, because these things still exist. But after the first 3 years of the first bond issue, I went to Levi Eshkol, who later became a prime minister, and I knew Levi Eshkol, and I knew them all, Ben Gurion, Ben Tzvi, I knew them all. So anyway, I went over there with the representative of Kuhn Loeb Company, one of the biggest Jewish bankers in those days, Kuhn Loeb. Ed Goldwasser represented, Felix Warburg. He was head of Kuhn Loeb Company. Mm-hmm. And we went over there, and we wanted to buy from Histadrut all these enterprises, and we would start an American company so they could have $500 million more to invest in local enterprises. At that time, Levi Eshkol was the executive director of Histadrut. See, and he was in the old-fashioned way in Europe, the executive director is the main, it's not a president, he's the main guy, see. I have all the documentation, by the way, where he okayed this, Levi Eshkol okayed this and okayed this and so on. I came back and we talked to Kuhn Loeb, we were going to start up. Levi Eshkol could not persuade his daughter to sell it, because they wanted to be sure to employ everybody, see, and so on. So they started the Orange Grove, all that kind of stuff, so on and so forth. To this day, in the Jerusalem Post today, there is a big movement on to privatize these companies today. They haven't done it yet, but they're beginning to, Israel needs cash. The development, the evolution, economic development, this is so fantastic, see, that they want to privatize it, see, but all the big industries, the electric company, the ports, the port workers, everything that works there, and the fertilizer chemicals, the big citrus groves, these are all owned by Histadrut.
Do you think this would make a difference?
I think it'll make it. In the first place, I think they have no choice. Second place, I think that's bad. I'm a great believer in I'm a great believer in government starting it, getting them going, and then privatizing it, you know, and government doing some more things. There are always things for government to do. There are always new people with new poor people or sick people. There's always something that you have to do, and so on and so forth. But I've been active for the last 10 years. See?
You're still very active, and your mind is still
people,
active.
People know my ideas, though, and I transmit all my ideas to the people in charge.
And we hope you continue for many years to come.
I hope so.
And we thank you so very much, Alex.
I think I've covered everything. I had a couple of notes here myself.
We really appreciate you.
I was a national chairman of Guardians of Israel. I don't know why I gave you that enough. I was a national chairman of Guardians.
Yes.
Make
yes.
A witness.
It has to be.
All the Fitz murder. Uh-huh. And I want that in, I want that known. Because it isn't known.
Okay. What is it?
There are two stories.
Want to repeat that?
There are two stories about Pittsburgh. I'll tell you the later story first, then the earlier story. So we talked about creating this bank, you know, like Federal Reserve, see, and the machinery for it. And we decided the best way to set that up was to set up a school at the Hebrew University called the Kaplan School of Economics. Eliezer Kaplan was the first finance minister, see. But they didn't have any money for it. I said, how much money do you need? They said, we need $500,000. Okay, I knew how to raise money. I come back to Pittsburgh. I went to a meeting of the Jewish Center here, and it was a rainy night, and Leon Falk was also a member of the board, and I lived right around the corner, but it was raining. So Leon says, can I give you a drive? I'll give you a lift back to the district. I was living right in this building here, see? Mm-hmm. Yes. So Leon says to me, yeah, he says, I know you were just in Israel and so on, so I said, you're just the guy I want to talk to. I said, we need $500,000 for the creation of a school of economics at the Hebrew University. Well, he says, go down and see Steele Gow tomorrow morning, will you, Alec? And the next morning I went down and I saw Steele Gow. And Steele Gow gave me $500,000 right then and there
from
the Falk Foundation.
Wow.
I want that to be known. Not only that, when the
from
Falk...
what year was this?
This, I would say, is in 1953, 54, something like that. Secondly, I want you to know that when the Falk Foundation was liquidated, I went back to Leon Falk, and I says, Leon, you're going to liquidate. He says, you can have another $500,000. I just want you to know that. It went to the Hebrew University. They don't know that here.
Why not?
I don't know why not. In the Falk Foundation report is there,
yeah.
But people, they don't know another thing I want to tell you about. And the other thing I wanted to tell you about was Saul Rosenblum. Saul Rosenblum was an intense Jew. And a few years I knew him, he never talked business to me, although we had our office on the same floor, 11th floor of the Diamond Bank building. Only talked every Saturday. I was single in those days, see, and I used to have lunch with Saul Rosenblum on Shabbat, you know. After Shabbat, we used to go for a walk up down Beechwood Boulevard. They had just bought that fancy house on the corner of Beechwood and Fifth Avenue, and so on. So we used to walk, and we used to always talk about Jewish things and so on and so forth. When I came here at the end of 1921, Saul Rosenblum became a friend of those Brandeis, because he was very much interested in Zionism. And he became a friend of Albert Einstein. When they created the Hebrew University in 1918, right after the Balfour Declaration, they bought four old buildings that Arab sheikhs used to have on Mount Scopus. They wanted to build a new building. And they couldn't, the Arabs wouldn't sell them any land. But Brandeis was determined that the first thing that they have to do for Hebrew University is to build a new building. And he went to Saul Rosenblum. And Saul Rosenblum gave him $1 million in 1921. Right, 1921 or 22. Saul Rosenblum died at the end of 1924 and we couldn't buy any more land. But Charlie Rosenblum was my business partner. And Charlie, we finally acquired the band and the first new building. Just want you to know, the first new building of the Hebrew University is the Rosenblum Building, and it's still there, and it's the law school there today. The first new building is the Rosenblum, and nobody in Pittsburgh knows that. See?
I think I saw that.
Mm-hmm. Sure, it's the law school there right now. At first it was for Judaic studies, but Judaic studies got so damn big, see, and so on there. And now it's now the law school. On Mount Scopus, the first new building is the Rosenblum Building. And I think people ought to know that. And I worked with Charlie, because all of them died. Charlie thought I knew more about fine arts and architecture and so on than he did, see. And I worked with him on the plans for it and so on and so forth. The first new building of the university. I'm part of that, too.
Wow.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
Phenomenal.
It's crazy.
Absolutely.